Yes, we are still here. You're listening to a third hour of a special edition of Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are taking your calls at 877-301-8970. Amongst the people we're going to talk to this hour is Jessica Stern, who's a terrorism expert. She's at Harvard about what the future holds for us. Speaking of the future, we're going to talk to a reporter stationed in London for the Global Post about what's in store for the London Marathon, which is just 5 days away. And one of our colleagues here from Boston Public Radio has been at Mass General Hospital, can tell us what's going on there with the injured and security and those sort of things. But in the interim, we'll take some of your calls at 877-301-8970. Let's start it with Linda from Lincoln. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Linda, thank you for the call.
Hi. I was at the marathon yesterday. My sister was running, and she was passing mile marker 26.1 when the second blast came. We had just seen her turn onto Boylston Street from Hereford, so we were right in front of the Heinz Auditorium, and so she came over and greeted us and then ran off, you know, to finish the race. And we heard the first blast, and it sounded like a cannon. I mean, that's what I thought, what are they, you know, blowing a cannon off for? And then we looked, and there was smoke. And then, you know, 15 seconds later, the second blast happened, and it was just a moment of absolute terror for us because we knew. I mean, I turned to my mother and I said, Nancy's right there. Nancy's going to be right there. And so I was with my brother-in-law, my mother, and my daughter, and we walked a little closer. We were in front of the Prudential Center, but by that point, the police had put up a, you know, basically created a barricade. They weren't letting anybody go past. And my brother and I stood there, you know, just saying, you know, what's happening, and just miraculously, I mean, she just walked through the police line. About 5 minutes later, she had witnessed it. She was just about 50 yards away from the second blast. She said it was something out of a movie.
How is she today, Linda? Have you talked to your sister today?
She stayed with me last night. They just left a little while ago. They're from Central New York. She was really in shock. She's a nurse, and so she, you know, she said, I was running, and we heard the first blast, and, you know, the strange thing is that after she had stopped to greet us, she ran, but then she created a cramp, started in her calf. Mm-hmm. She ended up walking, and when she saw the video of the people at the finish line, they were all the people she had been running with all day.
Oh, my goodness.
So had she not gotten the cramp, you know, who knows what would have happened. But she was in shock, really. She was just, like, and angry, kind of, because she was running this race in honor of my father, who just passed away in November. And he was a track coach, and it was her goal to finish the Boston Marathon for him. And she said those, you know, SOBs took that honor of crossing the finish line and getting my medal away from me. And the thing I wanted to point out is that she is determined to come back here next year.
Great.
And finish it.
Great.
Because she won't let somebody who is out to hurt and maim other people take that. You know, a wonderful moment away from her.
Thank your sister for us, Linda.
Yes, yes. I mean, I'm a 25-year resident of Boston. I've been to the marathon a number of times, and it's just like, I don't know. It's something out of this world. I mean, that's what I can say. It was an unbelievable moment. The reality sunk in that something just horrific was happening in front of your eyes, you know, and we were just we're all still stunned. It's a matter of processing what you saw.
That is indeed.
Linda,
we're glad your sister had got a cramp. Thank you for the call.
Very much for the call. You know, Linda said something that many people said yesterday, that this doesn't happen here. This doesn't happen here. You felt like you were in Israel or in Beirut or in Afghanistan, seeing the scene of a suicide bombing. You know, we are obviously happily isolated from a lot of this mayhem you see in the rest of the world. Although the Globe had a little mention this morning of all the athletic events that had been attacked before. And you remember way, way back the in 1972, the Palestinian terrorist attack.
But Munich.
At Munich, that's right. And the pipe bombing at the Atlanta Olympic Games in 1966.
96.
That's right. And this terrible attack on Iraqi athletes back in 2006, which I had totally forgotten about.
877-301-8970. Before you go back to the calls, I'm so glad you mentioned the thing about what people live through in whether it's Israel, Beirut. There are lots of locations around the world like that. And, you know, I like to think that we as a people and as individuals are empathetic, and I think we are. But the empathy is an abstract empathy until it comes to your hometown. Even if you weren't there yesterday, every single person with whom I've spoken has mentioned, I was at Abe and Louis. I was at the forum. I walked down that very stretch of road a week ago, a day ago. Everybody has a connection to it, and as a result, it totally changes everything. Let's go to Jane Ann. I hope I've got the name right. And Avon, you're with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Is that right, Jane Ann?
It's Janine.
Janine, I'm so sorry. My fault. Take it away, Janine.
I was just listening to the other caller, and I've been watching the news regularly, and I was about 100 yards away from the second blast, and, you know, my eyes were just seemed so surreal, and I just left the city to drop my little sister off at college, and, we both went home to our parents' house last night. We just felt like we needed to get out of the city, and my first reaction when I heard the blast, I was literally facing right in that direction with my camera up, ready to take a picture, and I saw the blast, and, you know, your brain goes through every possible explanation as to why that could have happened, and you knew that it didn't seem right, and then you see the second one, and, you know, my eyes went right up to the sky. I didn't know if someone was attacking us, and even today, going through the city, it felt like, with all the armed guards, it felt like there was a sense of war, a sense of, you know, there's just no safety. You just don't feel safe. There's a somber atmosphere in the city amidst the beautiful sunshine. And this is a city that I've spent 7-8 years in, and I've called this place my home. And I hate to say that I'm afraid.
You know, Janine, I have to say, one cannot talk somebody out of fear, but I have to say that I've gotten confidence from the from what we've heard from the police and other local officials. And when you talk about the stark nature, I don't know if you watched as much television as I did last night. When you looked at reporters who were standing maybe a block or two away from where the blast happened, or looking at reporters at Boston Common, and you look behind them, and other than police officials and maybe a random executive from the Boston Marathon, there was nobody. The city was deserted on one of the most celebratory nights of the year, yeah. The night of the Boston Marathon. Janine, thank you for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
We're joined by our WGBH radio, Boston Public Radio reporter, Ibi Caputo. Where have you been? You've been at the hospitals today, Ibi. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. So I was at Mass General this morning and Mass General in Brigham last night. And, you know, the scene, it's a little bit calmer than it was last night. There's less security guards out, but in lieu of them, there's SWAT team, Metro SWAT team, holding, you know, their rifles, standing at attention at the front entrance. Now, I talked with one of them. He said that they were there for visibility. Obviously, if something happened, they're there.
Not for a specific threat.
Exactly. Okay. So not for a specific threat. And then I also heard that the hospitals in general all were given this sort of protection just, you know, for visibility, just in case something happened, but there was no specific threat. And then, you know, the doctors came out. We heard from Dr. George Velmahas, and he is the chief of trauma surgery at Mass General. He was telling us about some of the injuries. As you know, there's been 176 people injured, 3 killed, 17 are still critical. Of that 17, 8 of them are at Mass General, and he talked about how 6 to 8 of them are medically sedated. There's no comas, but the pain is so severe that they've actually been medically sedated. He was saying that some of the injured, you know, the most traumatic injuries, they were blasts and what they're called traumatic amputees. And they did have to finish off the amputees at the hospital. He said that they pretty much had to finish up what the blast had started. He painted a really, you know, sad picture of that situation. He did say that there were four at the time when I talked with him, that there were four amputees and two limbs that they were still hoping to save on two patients who are critically injured. The other thing that I think is interesting to note, that the patients that they dealt with at Mass General, there were between 10 to 40 pieces of shrapnel in that they took either out of the subcutaneous level of skin or even deeper. And these were things like sharp pieces of something. They were pellets, he said, and nail-like objects. He had said that they were as if they were nails without the head on them. So he said, though he's not a ballistic expert, he said most likely it seems like that it was inside the bomb and that the bomb was placed low because the injuries were almost all lower extremities.
You know, that's one of the obvious ironies of this. These are all runners. And that the bombs were placed low, and you wonder, we have no idea, but you wonder about that, if there was some, I mean, if it isn't Tax Day or it isn't Patriots Day, it's some running thing or something, you know?
The thing that's really interesting, that those patients who got their legs, you know, who suffered these lower extremity injuries were spectators. He said that they had a few runners. One was kept overnight for observance, but then went home. And was released. So the odd, you know, irony or not, it's horrible that anyone had to go through this, but they were actually spectators.
Yeah, in the middle of Abby Caputo telling us about what was going on at MGH, I just want to say BostonGlobe.com is reporting that Crystal Campbell, we mentioned earlier, was the second casualty. We obviously know about the young 8-year-old boy identified. We had earlier said that she was from Medford. The Globe is reporting that she is from Arlington, but she is the second person, along with 8-year-old Martin Richard of Dorchester, who's identified amongst the three who so far have died. So what's their – did they talk at all? I'm sorry, I was just reading this piece and I may have missed this when you were talking a second ago. Did any of the doctors or the doctor with whom you spoke, did they talk about how – I mean, you mentioned medically sedated. Did they venture into the area about whether that number of three dead is about to grow because of how critical some of these injuries are?
Right. So Dr. Velmahas, he said that he's hopeful that these people will all live. He said they are critical. It's too early to tell, but that they were able to stop the bleeding fairly early. These people, because of what the Boston Medical, the MMS, you know, the ambulances, because they were right there on the scene, they quickly took them to the hospitals, to the area hospitals, and they were able to stop the bleeding. Now, if the bleeding had continued, he said that the heart can stop, that organs can go into failure, but they were able to stop the bleeding and replace the blood. So they have, he says that they're stabilized now and that they're hopeful that there won't be any more fatalities, at least out of those injured at Mass General.
Abby, last question from me. I'm not sure if it was a doctor from Brigham or Mass General last night, my apologies, talking about how remarkably prepared the medical facilities in and around Boston, obviously one of the medical capitals of the world, were for this. But did this doctor speak to that at all? I mean, many people are likening this to a war zone in many ways. How prepared were these facilities for this kind of carnage?
Well, it's interesting you ask. So last night, the chief of emergency services, Dr. Alasdair Khan, he said that at Mass General, they actually had consultants from Israel come and help them, you know, revamp their emergency disaster relief efforts. And then he said he's very glad that a few years ago they did that because it helped them in this situation. This is the first time both of these doctors said that they've seen injuries like this in such a quantity. So it was great. And they also had, you know, they had backups ready and backups to their backups. And even though the frontline doctors were pushing forward, the doctor today, George Velmahas, he said that they had limitless resources to use.
You know, he also said that same Mass General surgeon last night. He was talking about, he's a trauma surgeon, but his trauma is usually car accidents or it's shootings or it's stabbings. But as you said, they're not, these were warlike injuries. And many people yesterday at the scene were describing the sound of the bomb. Some people called it a cannon, but some people said it sounded like an IED that has killed so many of our soldiers overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that was incredible that they had to turn so quickly and be able to deal with shrapnel, with these pieces of nail. This is obviously something you don't see in Boston.
You know, also, when you were talking about Dr. Khan, is that his name from last night?
Yeah.
The moment that I will take away from that is, one, how calm he was in the face. He said he had been the head of the trauma
emergency
unit or something
services, yeah.
for 25 years. And at one point, and I think I'm going to get the words almost exactly right, he matter-of-factly, not without heart, but matter-of-factly said, there are a number of people suffering from traumatic amputations, if you like. Their legs were blown off.
Yes.
And I have to say, there was very little that made it as real for me last night as hearing this guy putting it in English for all the rest of us. It was horrifying. Ibi, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank
Ibi
you.
Caputo, who was at MGH this morning, and will continue to monitor this. Very good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Our number is
877-301-8970. Mimi from East Bridgewater is on the phone. Mimi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I don't normally do this. I'm a grandmother of 70, but I just had to tell you that the experience has been both heartbreaking and close to home for us as well. I have a grandson at Northeastern, and until he texted me back that he was okay, I think I just passed many years of my life.
How long, Mimi, how long was it from the time you first heard about what happened near the finish line until you heard from your grandkid? How long a period of time was that?
It was within 20 minutes of when it happened. I texted him right away, and I actually texted him before I called his mom because I was so afraid that she wouldn't be able to get through to him. It was probably 15 to 20 seconds for him to get back to me, but honestly, my life flashed before me waiting for him to text back that he was okay. He and his friends were on campus and decided to stay there for the day. So I'm most thankful to God for that. And when later in the day, my daughter sat down with his sister, who was 12, his younger sister, and explaining that Patrick was fine, that it was a terrific thing that happened, but that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't, everyone doesn't do cruel things like this. And unfortunately, we've grown up, unfortunately, I should say, that my generation and my children grew up in wartime and in peace. But it's not like that anymore. And when she said to Caroline, you know, it isn't always war, Caroline, we've had many years of wonderful life in the United States and very peaceful. And she said, no, Mom. She said, for as long as I can remember, we've been at war.
This is the 12-year-old?
Yes, she was born in 2001 in March. So it's a devastating thing to think of. But these young children have known nothing but conflict and war. And it's bad, isn't it? It really is.
Mimi, you said it beautifully, and good luck with your granddaughter, and I'm so glad your grandson is fine. Mimi from East Bridgewater. Joining us on the phone is a terrorism expert, fellow at the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at the Harvard School of Public Health, Jessica Stern. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica, we've had a lot of speculation, of course, about what these bombs were and, you know, domestic, international, all these sorts of things. What's your perspective?
Well, you know, at this point, it's very, very hard to say anything that isn't sheer speculation. It does seem to be...
Hey, Jessica, I hate to do this to you. This connection is so horrible. We're going to put you on hold 1 second, and one of our producers will try to get you on a better line so we can actually hear you. Jessica Stern, don't go away. We'll be back to you in just a couple of seconds. 877-301-8970. You can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. As you've heard, we've heard from a lot of people who are on the scene, on the site, and what they visited. And we've also heard from a lot of people who were not there, but who had great fear and worry because somebody they love was nearby. Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. We're here till 3 o'clock. Ralph in Providence, Rhode Island. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
I called just to make a comment. I'm in my 60s. I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And what I try to impart to my students, because I teach at a university, I tell them when your parents get on your case, remember this story. When I was a kid, the one thing that parents could say was, I know where my kid is, usually at school, and he's safe. I can't say that anymore.
Yeah. Ralph, we lost. We had a horrible connection there too. We got the gist of that. Ralph, thank you very much for your call. 877-301-8970. You know that lag time. The more people we hear tell stories, whether it's just a couple of minutes or whether it was hours, like lots of people had to wait last night. That time when you don't know whether the person you love or related to, your friend, is safe and even alive.
Well, that was one
is
of
as
the,
torturous as anything one can possibly imagine.
As I said earlier in the show, I was down in Kenmore Square and down by the Heinz Auditorium, and of course the police had blocked off the whole area. The press section was way down on Arlington Street by the Boston Gardens, Boston Common, Boston Garden there, and runners by the hundreds were stopped, and it sure they weren't always clear about why they were stopped. And then they heard about the explosions, and then they went into panic because they had their family waiting for them at the finish line, and they had no way to reach them. And even when they borrowed cell phones from people that did have cell phones, they tried to use the cell phones. The cell phones weren't working. So they spent 10 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour wondering if their families were okay. And many people that arrived at the hospital last night, of course, you're a marathon runner. You're wearing your outfit. You're wearing your sneakers. You have your number. You're not filled with an ID, and they were at the hospital anonymously, many of these cases, and it was quite some time before family members even realized their loved ones were hospitalized.
I believe we have Jessica Stern back on the line from the Harvard School of Public Health on a better line. Is that correct, Jessica?
I hope so.
Oh, it's perfect.
Yes,
it's good.
It's great.
Jessica, you started to say before we lost you because of the rotten connection that, you know, obviously virtually everything is speculation now. Well, that is what we're doing. Based on the objective facts that you know after almost exactly 24 hours, what is your speculation?
It appears to be a pretty unsophisticated group, and that sort of makes one think about single-issue groups like eco-terrorists, although that seems less likely, groups that are trying to promote al-Qaeda's vision by with do-it-yourselfer kind of attacks, which is what Inspire magazine is encouraging, even publishing recipes for how to make a bomb in the kitchen of your mom. And third would be, and probably most likely at this point, would be U.S. anti-government groups because of the Patriots Day date. That's almost a holy day for anti-government patriot groups.
Well, it's also, I mean, not only is it Patriots Day, it's Tax Day, which obviously is what funds the government that a lot of people, those people love to hate. And we talked before that just about this time, the Oklahoma City bombing was on April 19th, not that far from the state. You know, Jessica, are you surprised by, I don't know if you saw the press conference this morning. This may not be within your area of expertise. We learned virtually nothing when there were a parade of nine public officials led by the governor, other than the fact that the casualty number had gone up and that there had been no other explosive devices found, despite earlier reports, other than the two that went off. We've learned more since that from authorities about nails and ball bearings loaded into these devices. Are you surprised about how this is being managed by public official and law enforcement people, or is this standard fare?
Well, actually, it seems to me they're quite disciplined. I mean, I think they're really trying not to jump to conclusions of any kind, and the most important thing is to solve the crime. It's very hard. People, I think, have this longing to understand who did this and why they did it, as if that will take away the pain somehow if we understand it. And so we're all perseverating, you know, the nonstop news about the same thing, even though there's no news or essentially no news. I think the government is showing extraordinary discipline and professionalism. And I keep thinking about how we've had practice because of the extreme weather we've had in Boston in the last year or two.
Well, except that I would argue that in terms of the extreme weather, the criticism has been that we knew too little, and that there was too much discipline in terms of the people who were in charge of fixing what was ailing us, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think the reason we know so little is because we don't want to give the terrorists any information they can use. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's actually a sign of discipline. You know, maybe I'm being too kind to the government.
Well, I hope you're right, Jessica, because you want to think that after what we heard after 9/11 with the, you know, the lack of communication between these different law enforcement agencies and all the confusion, that we have learned something in these 12 years and that we are much better now in terms of these big terror attacks. This obviously isn't a 9/11, but it is a significant attack.
Jessica Stern, I have one last question. Looking forward, we've talked to a lot of people in your field this morning, and I don't know if there's conventional wisdom that if somebody is hell-bent on doing something like this, they can get away with it, but that's pretty close to what we've heard. Where do you fall on that spectrum? Is there, other than creating a total armed camp at a public event like a marathon that's not in an enclosed facility like at Gillette Stadium, is there realistically any way to prevent this kind of thing?
No, there isn't. You know, totalitarian states are much better at preventing terrorism within their borders than our free society. I don't think people want that.
Hey, Jessica, we are losing you yet again, so this time we got to let you go. Jessica Stern, I'm sorry about the phone connection. The Harvard School of Public Health, we really appreciate your time. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk to Michael Goldfarb. He's a reporter based in London for the Global Post, and the reason we're talking to him is 5 days from now, another world-class marathon, the London Marathon, and then we'll get back to your calls at 877-301-8970. You're listening to an extended three-hour version of Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Listening to Boston Public Radio, I'm Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Yes, this is an extended special edition of Boston Public Radio. We'll be with you to 3 o'clock. Obviously, the station will be covering all the developments throughout the day. And then you should be watching WGBH-TV at 7 o'clock tonight when Emily Rooney hosts the latest information on Greater Boston. Joining us now on the line from London is veteran reporter Michael Goldfarb. He's with the great Global Post. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Hi, Michael. So you have got the London Marathon coming up in just a couple of days, and I believe the funeral of Margaret Thatcher as well.
It's tomorrow. Yes, I mean, they've got these two big events. In fact, I was driving through traffic today, and you know, they're putting out one set of barriers for the marathon route, which partially is the same as the route that Margaret Thatcher's funeral procession will take from Parliament round to St. Paul's Cathedral, a distance of about 2.5 miles. But authorities are being very clear that they're reviewing their security arrangements, but this being Britain, what the security arrangements are kept very, very close to their chests.
Well, you know, you mentioned this being Britain. I don't want to say anyone ever becomes inured to this, because I don't think you do, but you have a long history in Great Britain of dealing with the Irish Republican Army, and there's been more incidents. This is a shock, I think, to us in the United States, because luckily this is a rare situation for us. But are the British any more, I mean, are they less nervous because they are a little bit more used to this, or what?
Well, I mean, I think we, because I've been here a very long time. I mean, the Brits have a very, very different attitude towards this. I mean, even, 12 and a half years ago, there was a major act of terrorism here, July 7th, 7-7, when 53 people were killed in a coordinated series of suicide bombings around London. It was amazing, and how quickly the city just went on, as if the best way to beat back anyone who's trying to terrorize you is to just carry on as normal. And that's ingrained. I mean, and I think it goes back goes back through the 80s and the 70s when the IRA was waging what it called its mainland campaign. It was bombing London. And, it goes back to the war, to the Blitz, when the city, great swathes of the city were flattened, and people got up the next day and they went to work. I mean, it was just a way of fighting back. But the more serious thing, of course, is that, when they run a marathon here, the police have had, decades of really much more experience dealing with penetrating terrorist groupings, paying attention, but all behind the scenes. We were talking, when you asked me about the marathon, I mean, the marathon starts out in Blackheath, the top of Greenwich Park, and then takes this long meandering run past, many of London's landmarks. And what you have to understand is that this city is possibly the most surveilled city in the Western world. I was just listening to my old friend Jessica Stern talking about, totalitarian states do very well at stopping homegrown terrorism. And, the trade-off for Londoners has been that there's been this growth of CCTV cameras. We know we're being watched, but we kind of forget about it and pretend that, it's all right. I think that, the security arrangements for the marathon will probably be what they always are. And you have to understand, when the finish line goes, past Buckingham Palace and then ends by the Houses of Parliament, if you can't protect in a very subtle and quiet way those two places, then you might as well give up. And the Brits are very good at protecting those two places.
Hey, Michael Goldfarb, I was going to ask you a final question about what you mentioned a second or two ago. I read as recently, I guess it was 3 or 4 years ago, that the average person in London is captured on a television camera somewhere between 300 and 400 times a day. Is that accurate, or is that number going even higher?
Oh, yeah. One of the early stories I did for Global Post was a video piece showing all the cameras locally in my neighborhood. And in fact, you know what they use the cameras for?
Mm. What?
Every once in a while, I get a parking ticket in the mail because they caught me making an illegal turn on a Sunday morning. This is what they do. They hire out the cameras to the local councils, and it's a way for the councils to earn money. Yeah, you're right. 300 or 400 times a day seems about right.
Well, not to me, but I got it. Hey, Michael Goldfarb from GlobalPost.com, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Sure thing.
By the way, GlobalPost.com does great work.
Great work.
Coverage of what's happening around the world. Joining us on the phone, before we get back to your calls, is a guy Marjorie and I both know who has suffered far more tragedy in his life than anybody should. And he was at the finish line yesterday at the marathon. He'll tell us about his story. Carlos Arredondo. Carlos, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Carlos.
Are you there, Carlos? Let's put Carlos on hold for
Jim,
a second.
How are you?
Oh, you
oh,
are there.
He is there.
Hi, Carlos.
Hi, Carlos. Can you tell our listeners, Carlos, why were you at the marathon yesterday?
Well, yesterday we were welcoming the National Guard, who was running on behalf of my son, and we was in the finish line.
And when you lost your son, Alexander, in Iraq in 2004, I believe. You also lost your second son 2 years ago. And so you were there. The National Guard was honoring your son, Alex?
Exactly, and also another lady from the Samaritans was running for Remember Brian on homicide prevention.
Yes.
So, Carlos, what happened? I know your intentions were there, obviously, to participate in the honoring of your two sons, it appears. But then what happened? How close were you to the blast? And we've all seen photographs and video of you. What did you then do?
The American Red Cross, I have the need, the responsibility to participate, helping out in the best I could. And being there across the street from where the first bomb exploded, was a responsibility to all help the others, very humane way.
And with the way you help, I think most of us have seen the photograph. If you haven't, you should, of you walking alongside a man who's in a wheelchair, who appears to be in shock, who appears to have lost part of one leg. And what are you doing? Are you trying to tie some tourniquet around his leg? Are you trying to calm him? What were you doing, Carlos?
Well, in the beginning, when I first jumped the fence and I landed in a puddle of blood, I saw 35 things, you know, but I'm pretty much concentrating and moving the fence, you know, at the time to get the first aid in, you know, the responders. And I am pretty much went back to help this young man. Even though was other people hurt in the ground, I only was working in one person trying to help him out. He lost his both legs, his limbs, and I talked to him. I gave him some comfort. They let him know the help was on the way, the he's okay. And after that, you pretty much another Samaritan person, another first respond who came to help me out to stop the...
Oops.
After that, you know, we moved this person very quickly into the ambulance.
And we all saw the picture, Carlos, and if listeners haven't seen it, they can certainly Google it, of Carlos Arredondo. You were standing, your clothing and an American flag that you had in your hand were covered in blood.
Yeah, when I first jumped the second barrier where the scene or the explosion took apart, I dropped my American flag in the floor, and I ended up picking it up moments later, you know, and put it in my pocket. I still have that flag, and was very emotional, the whole thing, very traumatic.
Carlos, thank you very much for calling us today, and thank you for your heroism yesterday, because that's what it was. We saw you pushing the wheelchair. We saw you holding the legs of the man who had lost them below the knee. Thank you very much.
Carlos, it's good to speak to you.
Thank you, Walter.
You know, we both know Carlos for quite a while, and, you know, the image of – we first met him after his son was killed in Iraq in 2004. And he essentially re-entered a war zone yesterday,
well,
9 years after his son's life was taken in a war zone.
For people that don't know the story of Carlos, who lives in Jamaica Plain with his wife, Melita, his son was killed in 2004 when the military men came to tell him that his son had been killed. He went into his van and set the van and himself on fire.
Mm-hmm.
He was rescued, and then he drove the van all around the country to protest the war in Iraq with his son's pictures on the side of the van.
They have been relentless peace activists. They have,
on the side of the van. Yeah. On Memorial Day, he and his wife go down and they place flags on every single grave all around the city of Boston. And as I said, he lost his second son in 2011. And there he was yesterday at the Boston Marathon trying to help people, in this case, a man who had lost his legs.
You're listening to an extended edition of Boston Public Radio. We're with you until 3 o'clock, and then there'll be comprehensive coverage throughout the day. When we come back, it's all calls and only calls until the top of the hour. The number is 877-301-8970. And our email, as always, is BPR, as in Boston Public Radio, at WGBH.org. Listen, Boston Public Radio, an extended edition of Boston Public Radio. We're here till 3 o'clock, followed by The World. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marge Regan. You can join us for the last 15 minutes of our show at 877-301-8970. Let's go to Dana in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Dana, thank you for the call.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. Thank you for calling us.
I wanted to point out that while what happened yesterday is really tragic and, you know, horrifying all around, I don't think enough people are counting their blessings. I was at the Red Sox game, and when the game ended, everybody in the park came pouring out to the finish line. And 45 minutes to an hour later, by the time the bombs went off, the crowds had subsided significantly. And, you know, while it was terrible what happened, the bomb could have been in the park with all the people, and I think that we got very lucky.
Well, not only could the bomb have been in the park, but if the timing had been differently, which I guess is what you were suggesting a couple of minutes ago, could it have been even worse at where it was? So that's a great point, Dana. Where were you when you found out what had happened?
A few blocks away. We'd left moments before.
Dana, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the call. Lewis from Boston, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. Hi, Lewis.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Listen, I just wanted to say that sometimes the people who go as experts, they have some opinions, they have understanding of what's going on, but they give a misconception of what happens in the concept of, in the issue of terrorism. The purpose of terrorism is to do exactly what happened yesterday, is to create a disturbance within society where everyone is uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we, you know, we have these symbols and guys standing at the hospital door with AK-47s and assault weapons, that can't protect you. If they check your bag on the subway, they don't know what they're looking for. I mean, a person who wants to create chaos in the subway won't bring a shaped bomb or, you know, IDP. What they'll bring is they'll bring some gas inside of a pin or inside of, you know, something that they can break open like a glow stick, and they create terrorism that way. The understanding is that even in societies like London or Israel, places where they have cameras everywhere, if someone is committed to terrorism, they're not trying to escape. And that's what we have to get people to understand, is that you really should share information. You really should let people know what they should be looking for so that, you know, the citizen can become a part of this process. But clearly in our society, you know, the issue of terrorism, the persons who did this at the marathon yesterday, this was about creating fear. This was about, you know, minimizing the issue of what people were celebrating.
Well, obviously, you know, Lewis, it's the definition of terrorism was lived out yesterday. But, you know, there are some examples, as you know, where acts of terrorism have been thwarted, whether it's the underwear bomber or it's the thwarted attempt at
Times Square,
Times Square at Los Angeles Airport as well. But, Lewis, every single terrorism expert who has joined us today in the last 2 hours and 50 minutes, and by the way, it is exactly 2:50 right now, which is exactly the time that the blast started yesterday, Lewis has said that if a terrorist has a brain and is hell-bent on causing havoc, that he or she most likely can achieve it. And so I don't think you have any dramatic disagreement with anybody with whom we've spoken. But, Lewis, thank you so much for the call. 877-301-8970 is our phone number. As of the moment, by the way, two of the people who were killed have been identified by authorities. Crystal Campbell, who apparently grew up or went to high school in Medford and now lived in Arlington, she was one of the three dead, and we've all been reading about Martin Richard, who was the 8-year-old boy from Dorchester, who not only was killed, but as you've heard, his mother suffered a head injury, his sister suffered a leg injury. So just a horrific, horrific notion for that family from Dorchester.
And Crystal Campbell, of course, was 29 years old.
Let's go to
Paul from Milton. Thank you for calling, Paul.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim.
Hi.
Hey, Paul.
Yeah, thank you for being there.
Thanks.
This timing is everything. I wonder what the ratings of your former station are today, if they have any.
No comment, Paul. Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm not asking for any.
Go ahead.
I want to speak about the medical staff. I mean, we are just so fortunate. I watched one of the doctors last night from the MGH come
out. Oh, he was amazing.
What confidence they build. And I get a little bit of family history of medical staff coming into a crisis. My late father was a resident at the Boston City Hospital the night of the Coconut Grove fire. And some of the initial skin grafts that for the burn patients that came out of the Coconut Grove, penicillin had just come into its own then. I mean, and you were talking about 500 dead. They used the Motamart as a morgue. It was so bad. The great work that was done and unfortunately comes out of these tragedies. A little coda on this. He treated one patient who was a Navy ensign. They became friends. He fell in love with the nurse who took care of him at Boston City Hospital. He moved back to Oklahoma, one of the states, I've forgotten. And about 6 years later, he was killed in a Jeep fire when his Jeep turned over.
Oh, my goodness.
So, but I mean, this, but specifically, a great medical staff we've had for almost a century here.
Yeah, Paul, you know, I was watching, and thank you for the call. I was watching that same surgeon from Mass General, the trauma surgeon. He's performed 6 surgeries that day. He was out meeting with reporters. Sometimes we disgrace ourselves by shouting all these questions, and he was as calm and controlled
and patient
as could be.
We should say, by the way, when I was talking to Paul a minute ago, I was joking. I have to say, with our former station, the coverage, wall-to-wall coverage of things like 9 9/11 were Fantastic. Amongst the proudest moments Fantastic. That I have ever experienced. Let's stay in Boston and go to James. You're on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Welcome, James.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I work at Town Stove and Spirits, which is on Boylston Street, as a security guard at the front door. And when the second blast went off, we, you know, it was, like many people said, like a movie. And people were running, just sheer panic on their face. And they first move was to come into the restaurant. And we could only let so many people in at the time. And then, you know, unfortunately, I had to close doors on people's faces because we didn't know who was coming in. And at that point, we didn't know whether if the bomb was, you know, set off in a backpack or if it was on someone.
Before you continue, James, is Town even open at 2:50 in the afternoon or is it not?
No, it's still part of the crime scene down there on Boylston Street.
So. No. I didn't mean today. I meant yesterday. Do you open that early or do you not?
Well, we open every day at 11.
Oh, okay.
But I was in at 10 yesterday, and then I was the last person to leave the building. When we evacuated all the customers, there was, you know, food left on the table, drinks half drunk on the bar. People's credit cards are still there. So it was pretty eerie just, you know, seeing these empty tables and just bars that are usually, it was packed full of, you know, we had 300 people in there.
James, how did you decide? Was it your decision or a colleague's? How did you decide when you reached the point where no more people could come into the restaurant?
That was my own decision, purely on the fact it was just becoming overcrowded. People were starting to sort of push each other. And then we were evacuated because the police came to the door and came in with me, and we essentially got everybody out as calmly and as cool as possible. But when they were first told to leave, you know, the amount of people pushing to get out of the one door that we had as an exit at that time was just incredible. You know, and there were children, you know, babies in strollers. So it was something I've never really seen before. And I grew up in the UK, and I was in London for the 7/7 attacks, but, you know, at a great distance from it. And this time I was only a block away from, you know, the second explosion. And it's truly surreal.
James, thanks for sharing your recollections of, again, exactly 24 hours ago yesterday. Let's go to Revere, where Tom is with us on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Tom.
Hi. Please bear with me. This is a very difficult, but I've been told I need to talk about it. So
sure.
you gave me a forum. I was at the, I was watching the race yesterday in front of the Atlantic Fish Company when the second bomb went off and I was hit. I saw the first bomb go off and, of course, looked in the direction of it towards Exeter Street from where I was standing. And within seconds later, I actually was walking a little bit towards it, but not far, maybe just about 10 feet at that point. But at that moment, the second bomb went off and threw me to the ground. I felt the heat. I had the concussion. So I'm still not able to hear very well. The ER doc told me that could take up to a month if it comes back. But I also, having been knocked to the ground, wasn't sure what was happening until a few seconds later when I noticed a pool of blood underneath me on the sidewalk, and then I found out it was coming from me. So I scurried around a planter, which was sitting in front of Atlantic Fish, which kind of designates their sidewalk cafe, and hid on the other side of it in case another explosion was going to happen. None did. So after about 30 seconds and another pool of blood under me, I decided I'd better walk somewhere. So I started walking up Fairfield Street towards Newbury. And the most impressive thing was two people, just people standing by watching the race, ran to my assistance because I wasn't walking too well and I was bleeding. And they performed first aid. One was a retired Marine. And another lady was told me about her experiences in battlefield as well. So I was pretty fortunate that they were there because they took good care of me until the EMTs arrived.
And where did the EMTs take you, Tom?
They took me to Mass General ER, where I was taken care of promptly, very professionally. They were wonderful also, as far as keeping me calm because I wasn't, I think I'm probably still feeling some effects of shock. But it's going to be a tough one to get past, and I'm sure. And truthfully, I'm one of the lucky ones. I don't know how I survived that blast, but I did.
Tom, we only have a minute left before we're off the air. How long was it until family, friends, people who were worried about you were able to find out where you were and what your condition was?
I started.
Oh, geez.
I started sending some texts from the ER, and then they were able to respond.
And Tom, you were released last night or this morning?
I was released last night around 9 o'clock.
Tom, we really appreciate your sharing the story, and we wish you well. And again, thanks so much for calling us here at Boston Public Radio. Well,
sure.
That's quite a way to end this particular three-hour edition of the show, I'll tell you.
Boston Public Radio is going to continue its live coverage all day long on the aftermath of the tragedy of the Boston Marathon. Emily Rooney will be doing a special presentation at Channel 2 tonight at Greater Boston. That's at 7 o'clock.
And tomorrow we will be back for a normal 2 hours, 12 to 2. We will obviously continue to explore the aftermath of the horror of exactly 24 hours ago. With you, with people who are involved, Brian McGrory from the Boston Globe will join us as well. That's it for today. The world follows us. We'll be back tomorrow at 12, and thank you so much for being with us.